My name is George Tinker. I prefer to go by the nickname Tink. And the title of this session is Kairos USA, an introduction to the American Kairos document titled From Kairos to Jubilee. And I've asked a number of people to respond to my comments and to respond from the vantage point of their reading and study of the Kairos document in terms of what it means to them. I'm not going to interpret the Kairos document per se to you. What I'd rather do is spend my time giving you some background about how the Kairos document came into being. It's an amazing document, has the support of some 100 different church-based justice and peace organizations around the country, from Catholic to Baptist and everything in between. Its ecumenical support is amazing. It's not a denominational document. There are no denominations who are invested in the document. It couldn't have been published if there had been. Lutheran involvement was done at personal cost and not with any funds from the ELCA. The only funding we had, per se, was from the World Council of Churches through Israel Batista. The document is short. It's not very long, and our hope this afternoon is that we can begin to interest people in congregations, in reading the document and using it in local congregations. Martin, come sit with us. The document deserves to be widely read. It's inexpensive. The group that is circulating the document for the Kairos USA Steering Committee is the Catholic group Pax Christi, and there's an address in the back of the document itself, and we can pass one around. Jim has one in his hands. Maybe you can show it to people around you. I want to start by suggesting that we all know that there are problems today in the world that begin with the United States and its function in the world. That there are problems even in what we call America, North America proper. And I want to say that the problem in America is one of idolatry. It has to do with the worship of false gods. Although I don't like to call them false gods because they're not really false gods. That's just good biblical language, only in a sense, Old Testament language. They are very real gods. Paul, for instance, knows that these gods exist, and hence he's very clear to announce which god it is he's talking about. God and Father of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ is one of his ways of identifying that God. God of Abraham and Isaac is another way of identifying that God. The gods that get worshipped on this continent, however, are multitudinous. We are a polytheistic society in North America. And the gods that are the real problem, gods are not, for me, the minor personal individual gods of career, of pleasure, of philosophical position. But the most powerful gods are those gods that capture the heart and soul of a people across the continent, the gods of economics, of political power, international power, and control. The god of capitalism, those are the gods that are the most important gods And there seems to be one God in particular in America who demands blood sacrifice to this very day. And we may as well get ready for it. We in the U.S. may be called upon to kill 200,000 or 300,000 people sometime in the next year just to keep this God happy. In 1990, the beginning of the year, I was beginning to lose my sense of optimism and hope when I was at a conference of theologians and teachers in seminaries and ran across a homiletics professor trained in Old Testament from one of the mainline seminaries in this continent on the eve of the U.S.'s involvement in the war in Iraq. And what really turned me around and set me straight and returned me to my Vietnam War days cynicism was when this homiletics professor, this person trained in Old Testament, insisted to me that in fact it might be necessary to go to war against Saddam Hussein in order to protect our way of life in the United States. That we would have to kill 200,000 or 300,000 innocent people in Iraq in order to punish one man who is still there. The problem is that we are being called upon to make sacrifices in that way in order, as senior pastor put it where I served in Oakland, California for many years, in order to protect our lifestyle, which puts way of life into a little different light. In 1990, in the midst of all of this, some 1,200 of us met from around the world in Seoul, South Korea, for the World Council's consultation on justice, peace, and the integrity of creation. The American contingent there included some people who began talking about the quincentenary, the 500th anniversary of when Columbus discovered that he was lost. They began to talk about the quincentenary as a Kairos moment, as one of those special times in history when a radical shift, a change in direction, might take place. We were few. There was Reeves Nawooks, a Comanche, myself, Joe Barnt, and Joe Agnew, the two Joes, Joe Agnew from most recently from the Racial Justice Task Force at the National Council of Churches, fired because he was too good at his job, and the National Council is veering to the right. Jim Wallace from the Sojourner Community, Walene Dodson, Howard Dodson's wife, from New York City, now teaches ethics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and Yvonne Delk, who was at that point a candidate for the presidency of the United Church of Christ. As we talked about how to make this Kairos moment real for all of North America, they called upon me to set the stage when we got our first pieces of the movement together before it became as widespread as it is today. While the movement's widespread, I'm afraid the document is not quite so widely read, and it needs to be, and that's one of my purposes this afternoon. Well, I was inspired during those days by noting the difference between culture heroes in the American Indian world and in North America. I was inspired by culture hero from my tribe, at least anthropologists call Coyote a culture hero. And as I looked at my mother's people, the white population of North America, it occurred to me that they have culture heroes too. They just tend to be mythic figures based on actual historical personages like Christopher Columbus and George Washington, and every Democratic Party in the nation has its Jefferson and Jackson Day fundraising dinner, right? Remember that it was Jefferson that stole Osage land from the Osages, and Jackson who removed all the Indians out of the Northeast in violation of the Supreme Court's decision in the case Worcester versus Georgia in 1930. Jackson was able to do that with the simple comment, "The court's made its decision, now let it send its divisions to back it up." And the liberals in the country celebrate this historical personage to this day. The difference between Coyote and all the white culture heroes is that white America tends to look for culture heroes that are somehow perfect, role models that reflect back to us who we are. So that Columbus is not a murderer and a slave trader, but Columbus is a scientific investigator out to see what's in the far reaches of the world. Never mind that he was a greedy entrepreneur looking for as much gold as he could lay his hands on. The myth is that he was actually out to discover new worlds and to expand Western civilization into the far reaches of the Americas. It's well known that Columbus started the encomienda system, whereby natives were given, along with parcels of lands, to his favorite captains, so that they became the enslaved possessions of this Spanish lord then. It's well known that Columbus insisted on native peoples bringing to him a certain amount of gold quarterly, at the risk of having their arm, their hands, severed from their wrists if they could not bring a hawk's bell full of gold ore every 3 months. And of course, those people died. Yeah, these culture heroes somehow have lost that cast of criminality and have instead become these perfect reflections of the righteous empire that Ronald Reagan still thinks that we are, at least if he can remember. On the other hand, in my Osage world, our culture hero is, let's face it, he just doesn't measure up. Coyote's a fool. I mean, he's not stupid. He's very smart, but he's a fool. He embodies everything that we want our children not to embody. Oh, he can be very powerful, too. We shouldn't forget that. Just because he's a fool doesn't mean he's powerful. In some traditions, Coyote even creates the world, usually by accident. There's a story about how the sun was brought out of the inside of the earth that demonstrates what Coyote is like. In those days, the world was completely dark because the sun was a recluse buried away deep inside of a mountain. And Coyote was going along one day. To understand Coyote, you've got to understand that stories, a lot of them begin that way, because Coyote never has anything better to do than to be going along one day. So Coyote was going along one day and feeling mighty hungry. You also have to understand a coyote's always feeling hungry. Doesn't matter if he just ate, he's already hungry. So he's going along one day feeling mighty hungry, and he decides to hunt for some lunch. And so he hunts the way he usually hunts. And two things you have to understand before I continue. One is that these stories are children's stories. You all have to be clear about that. Augsburg wouldn't publish these stories because they thought they were too risque for Lutheran adult clergy. But I want to assure you they're children's stories that we tell our children because we want our children to know about the world, so that when I tell you that coyote hunts by peeing in animal holes, like gopher holes and snake holes, you won't be too offended. Second thing you have to understand is that coyote's pee smells about as bad as anything in this universe. And it smells so bad that those animals just pop right up out of that hole when he pees in the hole, and coyote can grab his lunch. So he's going along one day feeling mighty hungry and decided to hunt for some lunch. When going over a mountain, he came across the biggest hole he had ever seen. As he leaned over and peered in that hole, he said to himself, "My, you know, it's this big. If I could get whatever's in there, I could eat for 2 or 3 days. So he bellied up to the hole and peed down into the dark blackness of that hole. It went down deep, and finally it hit the sun and began to sizzle and turned into vapor and smelled even worse than usual. And the sun couldn't stand it and came shooting up out of that hole, right, shooting right past Coyote into the sky. And suddenly, people could see for the first time ever. And Coyote looked around at everything and looked what he'd done. And he patted himself down there and said, "My, but you're a very powerful fellow." Coyote is well known, among other things, for having a sizable piece of equipment called his penis. So large that he has to roll it up and pack it away in a box to carry on his back. We're told that one day, Coyote woke up early in the morning and saw a flag on a flagpole way up away. And he said to himself, "My, but I've slept in too late. People are already having a powwow. I need to get up and get over there." And just as he rolled over too late, he realized it wasn't a flag flying from a flagpole, but it was his blanket on the end of his penis that had become erect during the night, and it came crashing down and smashed against the ground. And Coyote was sore for the rest of the day. Now, when we tell our boys these stories, what we're telling them is, son, be happy with what you got, because it could be so big and cumbersome that you'd have to pack it up and carry it on your back. And you'd look the fool to everyone in the village. See, we tell our children these stories because we expect them to learn from them how not to be in the world. And Coyote's a fool. There's no doubt about that. In one story, and I have to borrow another tradition because the culture hero in this tradition is the spider. But Coyote's his friend. So Coyote had been up from Osage country visiting in spider country. Ngtomi, the spider, Ngtomi was crying when Coyote came up and saw him. Coyote said, "Ngtomi, my friend, why are you crying?" And Ngtomi said, "Oh, Coyote, I just had the worst dream I've ever had. And Coyote said, well, he told me, sometimes it helps if you tell your dream. So why don't you tell me your dream and see if we can chase this nightmare away. So Tommy said, okay, I'll tell you the dream. In this dream, Coyote, I was up on a hillside overlooking a lake behind a rock. And down in that lake, a young chinchilla, a beautiful young woman, came to bathe in the lake. Coyote said, oh, Tommy, this sounds like an interesting dream. Well, Coyote, this young woman got undressed, got in the lake, and nature began to take its course. And I got an erection. Oh, said Coyote, this sounds like a great dream. What's wrong with this? And Tommy went on and said, as I watched her bathing, my penis got longer and longer and began to stretch down the hillside. I mean, it's really an amazing penis. And pretty soon, it made its way into the water. And Coyote's getting really excited and told me, this is the best dream I've ever heard. He said, my penis began to find its way to this woman. Oh, and Tommy, don't stop. Tell me the dream. And he said, and just at that time, a Washishu, a white man, and a wagon with a team of horses came racing down the hill between me and the lake. Coyote said, oh, and Tommy, that's a terrible dream. There's something implicit, inherent in that story that we want our children to learn about, especially want our boys to learn about how to be with women, how to treat women, how to respect women. And the story is a model of how not to be. The other thing that's being reflected back to us is, you can laugh at Coyote, but don't castigate him too much, because his foolishness really is us. Just as Columbus reflects perfection to America, and we can be proud and say, that's us, we're the righteous empire, we're perfect. So in the Indian world, our culture hero reflects back to us that we aren't so perfect, that we're foolish, just like Coyote is. One day, Coyote was going along, looking at the birds flying in the air, and he decided he wanted to fly. So he found his cousin Buzzard up in a tree. And he said, Buzzard, I really want to fly. Take me up on your back. And Buzzard laughed and said, no, Coyote, you'd fall, and then your death would be on my conscience forever. Coyote kept bugging him and bugging him, bugging him the way kids bug their parents, right? Huh? Yeah, take me, cousin, take me on your back. Because Buzzard's a big bird. Finally, Buzzard said, okay, but you gotta hold on tight. Don't let go. And so Coyote got on and held on tight. And Buzzard took off, and Coyote was in seventh heaven, literally, looking down at the world below him from a high, from the air, looking down and seeing all his relatives down there. It was wonderful. Except, you know, like children, Coyote eventually got bored. And as he got bored, he quit looking at everything down below and began looking at Buzzard's head. And he started laughing at Buzzard's head, because Buzzard's bald. And so he began using sign language. 30,000 different lexical entries, 30,000 different words and phrases in Plains Indian hand language. I mean, it's a complete language. You can do anything in sign language you can do in any other language, just about. So in sign language, he was saying, Buzzard's a fool. You know, Buzzard's a fool. Buzzard looks foolish. And he was doing it repeatedly and just laughing as he did it. But Buzzard had swooped in next to a hillside, pretty low, and the sun was casting their shadow on the hillside. And Buzzard saw what Coyote was saying behind his back. And Buzzard got a little angry. "Is that ingracious Coyote? I've taken him flying, and all he can do is insult me." And just then Buzzard saw a log. It had been hollowed out by lightning, but it was still standing. And so he flew down by that log, just tipped enough so that Coyote went flipping over and landed right down in that log and was stuck. Oh, Coyote was just crying, feeling so sorry for himself. That's one of his best things. But the more he cried, the more stuck he got. And the more he tried to escape, the more he fell down into it and got jammed and was stuck tight. And eventually, he got tired of feeling sorry for himself and began thinking about what he had done to Buzzard. And began feeling really sorry that he had done that. Began thinking, "You know, I really shouldn't have done that. That was nasty for me to do that. No wonder Buzzard treated me this way." And he began feeling sorry for what he had done. And the more he humbled himself, the more he got smaller and smaller and smaller, until eventually he fell to the bottom of that hollow log and scrambled out of the hole at the bottom of it. That's how he escaped. See, we're foolish too. Coyote is us. And when we realize how foolish we are, then we're in a position to do good and creative things in the world. That seems to me to be a much healthier culture hero than Columbus, who tells us that we are perfect, who sells us a bill of good, who lies to us about who we are. Well, that was my starting point early in the process that led to this Kairos document. One of the things that I wanted to say to people then and have said ever since is that in this righteous empire that we have built and have come to live and embody, here we can confess our sins individually every Sunday in church, but when we come together as the body politic, we know no sin. Right? There's no humanness left in the United States when we come together. In the midst of that, what I want to say is, not only do we know things are not well in the world, but I want to say that all those things that are not well in the world are connected with one another. It's not enough to take on a cause. In Denver, we have one group that deals only with Central America. For a long time, we had a Lutheran group that only dealt with Namibia. Another group that dealt only with South Africa. Another group that deals only with this, that, or the other. A group that deals only with the gang problem in Denver. In isolation, not knowing, not seeming to realize that if we can only change one or two policies, correct the system here and there, that everything will be just fine. See, the difference between liberals and conservatives in my mind is conservatives think the system works. Leave it alone, it works. You know, greed works. That's the capitalist system. The liberals, on the other hand, acknowledge that some people are getting cheated, that the system doesn't quite work. But it almost works if we can just fix the system everything will be just fine. If we can just elect the right person to office, everything will be fine. I'm afraid even in the two-thirds world, people tend to think in those terms sometime. In 1992, early in the year, at the third general assembly of the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians in Nairobi, in plenary sessions for 2 days, Africans, Asians, Latin Americans were attacking George Bush. And it seemed to me that that was misguided. So I got the microphone the end of the second day on a plenary session, and I said exactly that. I said, you all are identifying George Bush as the enemy, and that's a mistake. I said, George Bush is not your enemy. In 8 months, we're going to get rid of George Bush and elect somebody else, and your life's not going to be any better, because Bill Clinton is just one of the 10,000 George Bushes waiting to take George Bush's place. And now, nearly three years later, we know that to be the case. The problem is not who is in office. The problem is systemic. It's one in which every politician is owned lock, stock, and barrel by this systemic whole that can't help but continue its reckless drive to maximize economic surpluses in the United States at whatever cost to the poor in the United States and everybody else in the world. That's not going to change under a Democratic administration or an independent Ross Perotian kind of character who might assume the presidency, and it's certainly not going to change under the presidency of Newt Gingrich, who seems to think he's president these days. Even Bill Clinton seems to think he's president. This document, in my mind, is an amazing piece of work because it recognizes and names the systemic. It says clearly that we got to not just change a few policies, but we got to change our way of seeing the world, our way of living life on this continent before anything creative and good can happen. And it's got to start with those of us who recognize in Jesus' preaching the ideal of establishing the kingdom, the basileia of God. It's got to start there. It's got to start with people of conscience. This document, I think, begins to recognize that all our causes have to stand together, that we can't fix policy, but that we have to change the world. And of course, the risk is, and we got to be clear about the risk is that if we are able to do this thing, the standard of living of everyone in this room is going to be reduced. Are we willing to do that? The title of the document, I've got one more story after this, and then I'm ready to ask my colleagues to respond. The subtitle of the document, From Kairos to Jubilee, says what the document does at the end. It moves towards declaring a jubilee. You know, that time in the Old Testament, every 50 years, when debts are forgiven, land is returned, slaves are freed. And it's a nice idea. It's a marvelous idea. But we got to, and people in the two-thirds world love the idea. But what we got to understand is they're powerless to proclaim a jubilee. It's meaningless because all the resources and property is held in the north. So that if there is really to be a jubilee, again, this is the power of this document, the jubilee has to be declared from the north to the south. The jubilee's got to be declared by the master, by the property owner, the plantation owner, by those who have the economic wealth, by the north to the south. That's scary stuff, though. That's risky business. Can we really imagine that happening in the world? A coyote was a bit of a recluse from time to time. He's a loner because he's not a community person. See, that's one of another of the negative teachings from coyote, because we expect our people to be community people. To act in the best interests of the people, of the whole. When we dance a sun dance, it's that the people might live. When we suffer in an inipia, sweat lodge, or a purification ceremony, it's so that the people might live. We offer our flesh in those contexts, not to placate an angry God, but as a vicarious sacrifice for the people. So coyote was going along one day and stumbled into a conference of all the people in the world. It wasn't far from here, a little to the west, where the people were having a conversation of despair because there was a beast that was consuming everybody. Buffalo was there, elk was there, squirrel was there, these little golden mantled squirrels that some people call chipmunks. Alvin the chipmunk was a squirrel, you all know that. Eagle was there, sparrow was there, everybody was there, all the people. And Cowdy listened from the back while they were saying, it's no use even struggling against it. We're all going to get eaten. And Cowdy couldn't stand it. How can they give up like that? How can they just give in to this despair that this is the way things are? This is the real world. And so Cowdy, like he's wont to do, again made an ass of himself by stepping out into the middle of the clearing and beginning to talk to the people, to rile them up, to tell them they need to fight this beast, they need to do something, they need to have a plan, a strategy for action. And he suggested what you need is to elect someone, pick someone to go do battle for this against this beast on your behalf. And boy, the more he talked, the more people got excited about this. You know, they were ready to go. They were suddenly feeling good about themselves again, thinking that they could change the world. So finally, Bear said, Cowdy, you have convinced us. We're going to do something about it. We've chosen someone to go do battle against this beast for us. And that person is you, Coyote. Well, Coyote hadn't been up for that. That wasn't what he had in mind at all. But Coyote's also got a lot of pride. So he couldn't say no. So they had ceremony for him before he went to do battle. 4 days they prayed for him, danced. And they gave him each day a flint knife to stick in his belt. So he had 4 flint knives. So after the 4th day, he left to go find this beast. And he thought about leaving, about just fading into the wilderness, because he figured he could stay away from that beast and he'd never see those people again. But he was too proud, so he started heading off towards that beast and got to where he could hear the beast, but couldn't see it. So he climbed a mountain from that mountaintop, he could see the beast off in a distance. But worse than that, he could begin to smell the beast, and it smelled awful. And just at that moment, two things happened. First of all, Coyote chickened out and decided to leave. And secondly, the beast took a breath and drew Coyote right tumbling down that mountain towards the beast, and Coyote was trapped. He couldn't leave. And with each breath, Coyote swept closer and closer to the mouth of that beast. And he knew he was in for it. Pretty soon that beast opened its mouth, took in a breath. Coyote went tumbling over the teeth, past the fangs, over the tongue, and went sliding down the throat of that beast. As he slid down the throat into the darkness of the beast, he reached out and grabbed the sides. You know, proud to the end. He just scraped enough fat off the throat of the beast. He slicked down his hair so he could look good when he got there. And pretty soon, kerplop, he tumbled out into the belly of the beast. And there were all the people that had been swallowed. Some of them were just empty. The life had been sucked out of them. They were just shadows. Others were in various states of life. Some of them had just been swallowed. And boy, they were surprised to see Coyote. An elk said, Coyote, we didn't think you'd end up here. We thought you were too smart to get swallowed by the beast. And Coyote dusted himself off and said, well, I'm here because I want to be here. I came to kill the beast. And they all laughed at him and poo-pooed him and said, you can't kill the beast. I mean, let's face reality. This is the real world. You can't change the way things are in the world. But Coyote got them excited too. He said, well, I need your help, but we can do it. And pretty soon he had them all lined up to help him. So that they built this human pyramid up to the heart of the beast. And Coyote was standing on top of that human pyramid, weaving back and forth a little bit because it wasn't too stable, pulled out the first of his knives and began hacking away at the arteries that connected to the heart of the beast. And the beast began to harumph and growl and make noises and finally began to plead with Coyote to stop. And as the beast shook, that whole human pyramid would rock back and forth. And Coyote cut one artery and throw the knife away and grab another one. He used up three knives and finally cut that heart right out of the beast and used his fourth knife when the beast fell over to slit open the belly of that beast from one end to the other. He brought all the people out, took even those who had died into a sweat lodge and poured water on rocks until they were revivified again and came back to life. Of course, the beast is never completely done, right? I'm told that over there on the Snake River in Idaho, there's a beautiful canyon, a deep, deep canyon, where you can still see the belly of that beast open, and it's been transformed into something beautiful and gorgeous in the world. Well, what we're up against, as you look at the violence in America, look at the violence on TV, look at the violence that we perpetrate in Iraq and Guatemala and El Salvador, other places around the world, Nicaragua. You know that there's a beast and that we're a part of the beast that is raging in the world, consuming the world. And what we got to do is get ourselves together to kill this beast. It's the only way to cut its heart out from the inside. I don't know how we're going to do it. I'm not Coyote. But maybe Jim can tell us how to do it. We've got to have a strategy, a way of doing it. This document is the beginning of a movement that can touch people, guide people, bring us together so that we can work together from from one coast to the other, from north to south, in order to change the reality that we have inherited, to change the violence, the culture of violence that has become this beast that we are a part of. So I'd like to invite I'd like to invite these four colleagues to respond to the document, not to me, but to the document, in terms of their study of the document, what it means to them, what it says to them, what hope maybe it portends. And then I'd like, when the four of them have spoken, to get you all involved in some conversation before we have to break for supper. So we can start anywhere. I have no shooting order. Carrie, your last name is?
Donner.
Donner, Carrie Donner from Holden Village. Mm-hmm. Martin Wells from Holden Village, one of the co-directors. Elmer, you already know. And Lauren Abieta, and how do you pronounce it? Abieta. She was told in Denver one time, anybody with that name sure doesn't belong in this country. Lauren Abieta, my wife, from Graduate School of International Studies, human rights scholar. So who'd like to begin?
I think Martin's our leader.
Martin's our leader. I struggled with this document. I didn't keep my covenant with the study group to see the conversation all the way through. Partly that was because I got to traveling on behalf of village business in the spring, and partly it was because I was confused and angry and didn't know what to do with what I was facing. I suppose that is a pretty good definition of what a prophetic call does to me. So I'm still absorbing it. And as I've been looking through my notes, the thing I haven't come to grips with yet is the human anthropology that I have swallowed hook, line, and sinker from my training, from my Bible study, I hope, that says in Reformation language, we are at once both saint and sinner. And I want to ask, maybe as my first question is, what is the human anthropology? What is the understanding of the possibilities of humanness that undergirds a document like this? Best case, I suppose, is that a document like this would begin with confession, that we are all complicit in the situation as we find it. I would have been more comfortable if the document had begun with confession. But from there, if we go through the question of what the possibilities are for the human one in this life, being both saint and sinner, then what are the how do we realistically address the terrible issues that are raised here of, and appropriately, of structural injustice and a collapse of values and violence and a disintegration of family life and disrespect for life, economic injustice. I'm still stuck. And one way of defining that stuckness is that it's a coward's hiding place, because if you can sufficiently complexify your life, then you don't do anything, because you can become paralyzed. And I confess that more often than not, that's probably where I end up. And yet there also seems to me to be a role for people who constantly hold in tension that we are saint and sinner, and that perfection in this life is not an option, and that we learn to live with tilting against powers as best we can without falling into despair. I don't know what else to add at this point.
I don't know exactly what to add either. I was involved in the same study that Martin was, and it was that took place probably ended by May or so, and I haven't really talked about the document with anybody since that time. I guess I would just say that for me it was, I suppose, in one way encouraging and in another way discouraging to have all these societal ills named and to realize that I was indeed a part of that. Even though I guess that's something that a person sort of knows at various times anyway, but here they were named, and it was very readable and understandable, and even though it's like knowledge to be complex, it seemed presented in a very understandable form, all those complexities presented in an easy to read and talk about form. And I guess also presented in a way that made it seem very hopeful that there's something that we can do together about this. We don't just have to sit there in our sins. I guess I did take the naming of these things as a type of confession. So it was, to me, that was a part of it. I need to comment a little bit to something that you said.
Sure,
anyway.
Anything's fair game.
Because as you were talking about the protection of the American lifestyle being a god, and there was something individual about lifestyle too that you said, but it reminded me of a monologue that I heard Garrison Keillor say one time. He was talking about Jesus, and he thought that Jesus had a much easier time of life than Garrison himself did, because Jesus didn't have to support a lifestyle, you know. Lifestyle became sort of a popular thing in maybe the late 60s or so, that before that I don't know that supporting a lifestyle became or was a thing that people thought they had to do, but it made me think of that. I just have to say it. I don't have anything else to say yet.
Lori?
Okay, we'll just go in order here. When I did garbology last week, the document came to life for me. And I think that doing garbology, I don't know how many of you have done garbology yet, mm-hmm. but some of you may be new, but garbology is where you take care of the community here, the community's trash, but it isn't just collecting the trash, you sort the trash according to what goes in landfill, what's recyclable, and what will be compost. And then there's other, you know, the recycling becomes even more complex within that. For me, doing that that part where we spread all the trash out on the table and sort through it was like a confession. And it showed me how complicit I am and how complicit all of us are in this incredible system that is killing the earth. And so that was the real down part of doing garbology. It was depressing. The hopeful part was doing the composting. The composting was giving it back to the earth. And it was amazing, you know, I mean, we saw some really horrendous things in there, just whole pieces of bread that just, you know, just got thrown in there, and people throwing in plastic bags filled with food that was, you know, decomposed. I mean, the whole thing was really an eye-opener. The other thing that about it, though, that I thought was important for me and that brought the document to life, actually, was that doing the composting, it smelled like Haiti. And I'm cautious saying that because I don't like saying, oh, it's, you know, like this third world country stinks. Yeah. I want to be careful how I say that. But in Haiti, when you get off the plane, the minute you get off the plane, it smells like the compost pile. Add in dead bodies and raw sewage, and you have Haiti. And yet at the same time, that wasn't entirely despairing for me. Because actually I kind of adjusted and liked the smell of Haiti after a while. I miss it. And when I smelled it, I realized I missed it, because this was sort of like, you know, this is reality, this is the real world. And if you think about the United States, I always say when I come back from Haiti, that it's like being smothered in a blanket. It's like having this blanket wrapped around me and I can't breathe. I can't move. Nothing is real. I'm not alive anymore in this country, because you don't smell life. And you don't see life, really. I mean, everything is very artificial and antiseptic in this country. And so I think that, you know, that was important for me, to see garbology as kind of, and when you all do it, you know, if you've read the document, think of the document. It is a confession. You go through stages and then...